This year, more than 1.5 million new college grads will hit the job market in the U.S., and we've been meeting a few of them this week in our series, Setting Out. Today, reporter Emily Ritter of Montana Public Radio has the story of a young Native American who's trying to figure out what to do with his degree in television production.
For the last few years, Buddy Cowart has been stocking the shelves at a local home improvement store, working part-time to pay his way through college.
We have these ones up here.
The Native American 29-year-old is the only member of his family to get a college degree. It just took him a while to do it.
This is year 8, finally, so I should be a doctor or a master. There should be a master of something, but I'm just a bachelor.
This spring, Buddy graduated from the University of Montana School of Journalism with a degree in radio television production. He was born in a small town near the North Dakota border to a teenage mom and was later adopted by an older couple in Missoula. After high school, he decided to head straight into the workforce, but soon realized he wanted something more. When Buddy first told his parents he was signing up for classes at the U, they weren't really sure how he'd pay for it. He relied totally on student loans.
When you're in school, you're learning, you're getting these statements about what you owe, but you're not really, you're like, oh, I don't have to pay on that till I graduate. That's not for 8 years, especially if you're me. So I'm like, you know, I didn't really think about it, but then now that I'm graduated, you know, the reality is sort of setting in, like, oh, I have to pay this back.
Buddy racked up $50,000 in student loan debt. He'll have to start paying that back later this year. Between finishing up his senior project, graduating, and working close to full-time at the home improvement store, he hasn't had time to start applying for jobs.
It would be ideal for me to find a job just shooting video. That's what I love to do, and editing it, and traveling around and meeting people and just hearing stories, or else having my own business. That's something I'm seriously considering.
Often the entry-level jobs are sitting in an edit bay overnight logging tape that someone else has shot. But that's where they start.
Denise Dowling is one of Buddy's professors in the journalism school. She says most of the 2010 graduates coming out of the J school already have jobs, and most know they'll need more than one job in order to make ends meet.
The reality is the wages aren't good because there are so many people who are willing to do the work that it does take time to get to a point where you really feel like you're making a good living at your career.
Back at the home improvement store, Buddy says he was expecting to take on full-time hours here once he graduated. In summers past, he'd work 40 or more hours a week to save up for the school year, but this year's different.
I'm only getting 30 hours a week, and my boss has told me that's all he can give me right now because things are tough, and I'm lucky to have that. So what do I do now, you know? What do I do now? What do I do now? I just really don't know.
When Buddy chose his major, the TV production industry was completely different and the recession hadn't even started. He wanted to pick a career that would allow him to be creative, working on documentary projects and long-form storytelling. Those jobs are few and far between around the country, especially in Montana. And for now, Buddy wants to be able to stay close to home so he can continue caring for his elderly father.
How am I going to start off at making minimum wage, maybe? That's a whole nother reason why I feel like I need to get a job in what I went to school for. Is just, I just don't want it to go to waste.
He doesn't want to disappoint his father, his teachers, or himself. For NPR News, I'm Emily Ritter in Helena, Montana.
Tomorrow in our series, we meet a new graduate who's trying to find his groove as a professional musician.
I'm a percussionist, so we tend to be pretty laid back. I mean, if all else fails and I can't find a job, I'll have to get a normal job for the first time in my life.
That's tomorrow on our series Setting Out here on Morning Edition.
The financial regulation bill now before Congress could rebuild some of the walls between banks and the rest of the financial world. The idea would be to limit the risk your bank can take. The bank can do whatever you want with your money, but the bank would be limited in the kinds of investments it can try on its own. That proposal is one of the final issues unresolved as the bill nears completion. Here's NPR's John Itzty.
After the Senate passed its version of the financial overhaul bill 2 weeks ago, some analysts suggested that consumer forces had prevailed despite the hundreds of millions of dollars the banking industry spent trying to influence the outcome. But the battle isn't over yet. It will continue during the next few weeks when a handful of lawmakers on the House-Senate Conference Committee make final decisions on the bill. Heather McGee of the consumer advocacy group Demos says the next few weeks will be key.
There's a very narrow window of time. There's a very small group of members to influence, and it is sort of the Super Bowl of lobbying right now on the Hill.
Scott Talbot of the Financial Services Roundtable declined to discuss any details of the industry lobbying effort. He says his group actually supports most of the overhaul legislation. It only has problems with about 20% of what's in the House and Senate bills, he says.
About half of the 20% is still on the table for discussion, and depending on which way the conferees go, could move the needle on one way or the other.
One provision the big banks hope to defeat in conference committee is something called the Volcker Rule, named after the former Federal Reserve chairman and current White House advisor Paul Volcker. It would ban banks from Main Street to Wall Street from what's called proprietary trading. They'd be able to trade in financial markets on behalf of their customers, but not for their own profit. They'd also be barred from owning equity funds or hedge funds. Scott Talbot says the Volcker Rule is counterproductive.
Proprietary trading, as well as investment in hedge funds and equity funds, are a solid asset management technique, and when done properly, help the bank manage its own risk as well as the risk for its clients.
The banks are arguing to the House and Senate conferees that proprietary trading shouldn't be banned. Instead, banks should be required to hold more capital, bigger cushions against losses for more risky investments.
This is the devil in the detail stage, and it turns out the devil works for the lobbyists.
Simon Johnson, a former chief economist at the IMF, says there's still plenty of time to influence the bill.
This is where, you know, if you're on the inside and you know the tactical details and you can sway key voices at key moments, you can really gut a large part of what still remains on the meaningful side of this legislation.
Johnson is the author of 13 Bankers. The book is highly critical of the risky behavior of the biggest banks that fueled the financial crisis. He supports curbing their risky behavior with measures like the Volcker Rule. But he points out that Congress has left it to regulators to craft the details over the next 2 years. He says that means the Volcker Rule will be gutted.
When you want to kill something, the best way to kill it is not actually to have a big all-out fight and vote it down on the Senate floor. The best thing is to send it off somewhere for study with very vague terms of reference. And you can be sure that by the time it comes back, it will have taken on board a lot more of the bank's preferences.
Economist Robert Lytan, a vice president at the Kauffman Foundation, acknowledges bank lobbyists can have a big effect during the rulemaking process.
When you get into talking about the nitty-gritty details of the fine language of bills, this is where lobbyists earn their money.
But Lytan doesn't blame the banks for trying to defeat the Volcker Rule. He says banks are inherently risk-taking institutions. Every loan they make is a risk, for instance.
I think the idea that we can significantly constrain their risk by enacting some version of the Volcker Rule is close to fantasy.
Lytan says over the next 2 years, as regulators work out the details of the Volcker Rule, the current anti-bank anger will probably subside. He says that will allow more rationality and less emotion to be applied to the issue. John Idsty, NPR News, Washington.
And those with newly minted accounting degrees have one of the best chances of getting a job offer this year. Even then, it won't be easy. Imagine what it's like for a music grad hitting the job market. In the latest story in our series, Setting Out, Rachel Ward of member station WXXI in Rochester, New York, meets a young man who wants to be a full-time percussionist.
In the middle of finals, 26-year-old Ivan Trevino has a gig in New York City coming up, graduation just around the corner, and now he's gotten himself involved in this.
Man, this is another thing I have to practice. You know, I should have written an easy year.
Ivan is a percussionist, just finishing up his master's degree at the prestigious Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York. He wrote this piece for cello and marimba for two friends who are getting married, and he's only got 2 days before the wedding to get it down.
But basically, the idea is that the marimba part and cello part are very different from each other. One's in a different meter, the phrasing is all different, but somehow when they play together, it seems to make more sense than it does when they're apart. And that's kind of the same idea with my two friends who are getting married.
Ivan's used to pulling all the pieces together and making them work. He plays percussion in a cello rock band called Break of Reality. On top of touring and recording, they played South by Southwest this year, and they're in the running to do a film score. Ivan did have time for a conversation in a student lounge at the Eastman School. He says juggling all of this stuff is just how life is if you want to be a full-time musician and pay off your student loans.
You know, you got to be able to do a lot of things, play and do the music business thing too. So you have to make yourself as well-rounded as possible. I think that's the way to go.
It sounds like you have to be an entrepreneur.
Definitely, without a doubt.
But Ivan doesn't have the luxury of going without making money for 2 years like most entrepreneurs do. Bills for $60,000 worth of student loans will start showing up in November. So stability is attractive to Ivan. He even briefly considered joining the National Guard band before deciding he didn't really want to go through basic training.
Hopefully I'm not spreading myself too thin, but I don't think I am.
But it's not freaking you out.
No, I don't think so. I'm a percussionist, so we tend to be pretty laid back. I mean, if all else fails and I can't find a job, I'll just, you know, I'll have to get a normal job for the first time in my life.
We want people to be as productive and happy and interested in what they're doing as possible.
That's Heidi Scherholz, an economist with the left-leaning Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. She says when people like Ivan, someone who started drumming in his family's touring gospel band as a little kid, when someone like that follows their dreams, it's better for the economy.
There's no crystal ball. We don't know what's going to be the winner industry going forward. But what we do know is that as an economy, if young people are going into things that they enjoy and that they're good at, that's how the economy will work best.
Scherholz acknowledges that some sectors like healthcare and education are more stable during recessions, and musicians might have to find refuge there during hard times. But for Ivan, who's already done the whole move to New York with the band after college, that's not actually a bad thing. He doesn't mind settling down in Rochester.
I love to teach, probably even more than playing. And I think what I need to do is let people know, almost annoy people with the fact that I'm going to be here and I really want to help. So yeah, I think by September, you know, I got to know what I'm doing for sure.
But if he doesn't know by the fall, he figures he'll find some gig, even if it's just a normal job. After all, musicians are used to improvising. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Ward in Rochester.
Tomorrow, we talk to an expert about who's got the best chance of finding a job and who will need the most patience.
For teachers, education majors, this was the weakest year we've seen in a long time. They actually fall at the very bottom of the majors list in terms of getting job offers.
That's tomorrow on Morning Edition.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. President Obama says stopping the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico is by necessity his top priority right now. But yesterday, the president took time to discuss another pressing concern, the economy. Speaking at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, he said the economy is moving in the right direction without help from Republicans in Congress. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The U.S. economy is in the midst of a U-turn, and President Obama is claiming some of the credit. Economic output's on the rise, consumer confidence is up, and when a new employment report for May comes out tomorrow, it's expected to show more than 500,000 new jobs.
This economy is getting stronger by the day. Now, that doesn't mean this recession is by any means over for the millions of Americans who are still looking for a job or a way to pay the bills. Not by a long shot.
Mr. Obama says the nascent recovery still needs all the help the federal government can muster. That includes extended unemployment checks for people whose benefits have run out, more subsidies for health insurance, and more aid to cities and states so dwindling tax revenues don't mean more layoffs for cops and school teachers.
The economy is still fragile, so we can't put on the brakes too quickly. We have to do what it takes to ensure a strong recovery.
But Mr. Obama's beginning to meet resistance, even from members of his own party, who wonder how long the federal government can afford to keep pumping up the economy with borrowed money. Last week, the House had to scale back a jobs bill in order to secure the votes of fiscally conservative Democrats. Economist Diane Lim Rogers of the Deficit Watchdog Concord Coalition says it's time for the government to start thinking about how to gracefully withdraw its economic lifelines.
We are in recovery. We just need to get to a place where we show signs that we have a plan to pay our bills. And I think that that is a concern right now, that we don't have a plan.
Others argue that fixing the deficit can wait. Larry Michel, who heads the labor-backed Economic Policy Institute, notes that unemployment is still painfully close to 10%. He'd like to see the federal government borrow more money, if necessary, to put more people back to work.
This is not the moment you want to switch to doing deficit reduction. If you want to build a new foundation for growth, as the president suggests, you know, first we need jobs.
That new foundation is a blueprint President Obama first sketched out more than a year ago in a speech at Georgetown University. He called for fundamental changes in health care, education, and Wall Street regulation. Yesterday, he was able to boast of some progress on those fronts. Health care overhaul is now the law, and new rules for Wall Street could be soon.
Now, some of you may have noticed that we have been building this foundation without much help from our friends in the other party.
Congressional Republicans make no bones about opposing the president's agenda. House Republican Whip Eric Cantor said yesterday, the path to prosperity lies in smaller government and a growing private sector. Mr. Obama countered, in a theme likely to be repeated between now and November, there are times when only government can do what individuals can't and corporations won't.
That's how we have Social Security and a minimum wage and laws to protect the food we eat and the water we drink and the air that we breathe. That's how we have rules to ensure that mines are safe and, yes, that oil companies pay for the spills that they cause.
Mr. Obama used the BP oil spill to push for another plank in his new foundation, cleaner alternative sources of energy. He promised support for a comprehensive energy bill, now before the Senate, that would put a price on carbon emissions.
The votes may not be there right now, but I intend to find them in the coming months. I will continue to make the case for a clean energy future wherever and whenever I can.
Mr. Obama says that Senate bill includes Republican ideas, even though at this point it has no Republican support. Scott Horsley, NPR News, The White House.